Welcome back to the third hour of Issues, Etc. In about 25 minutes, we're going to be hearing from Jim Toohey, Director of White House Office for Faith-Based Community Initiatives. The president's latest budget submitted to Congress comes to $2 million, not counting a few very significant things. One thing it does count is increases for faith-based initiatives. Is this a winner with you? This is something that the president has stayed on message in the last 4 years and expects to for the next 4 years, faith-based initiatives. What in the world is the appeal here in this issue? It becomes a budget priority as well. When we've talked about this issue in the past, even when it was first introduced at the very beginning of the Bush administration, and we even raised questions about, you know, will this be kind of an unseemly connection between government and church? Will it create a strings or a sense of obligation on the part of churches or faith-based organizations that participate in this and take federal money for social work? Crickets. No response. Very little response from you, our audience. Very little reaction from you on faith-based initiatives. What's the appeal here? I want to talk about it in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Bryce Christensen joins us here. In the meantime, we're going to be talking about the de-evolution of marriage and homosexuality. Bryce teaches English at Southern Utah University. He is author of the book Utopia Against the Family, and he's also written an excellent article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Rush to Alter, that's A-L-T-E-R, How Homosexuals Benefit from the De-evolution of Marriage. Bryce, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Well, you make the case that homosexual activists are really latecomers to the whole assault on marriage. What do you mean by that?
Well, marriage has been under attack for decades by people who had no particular ties to the homosexual movement. We saw marriage being deconstructed, redefined by people who quite successfully pushed through laws that made marriage weaker than the weakest of at-will contracts. We saw marriage culturally, not legally, but culturally, weakened by heterosexual advocates of sexual freedom, premarital, extramarital. We saw marriage weakened culturally by so-called dinks, the double income, no kids, who made marriage a matter of psychological self-indulgence and removed from marriage its traditional responsibility for bringing children into the world and rearing them with a strong moral orientation.
So do you think that the original combatants in the assault on marriage, largely heterosexuals, who were the proponents of the sexual revolution, do you think they ever thought it would come to this, that we would have now a pretty major push for same-sex unions or same-sex marriage?
Probably most of them did not, but I think most of them didn't care. I think that their social vision was highly individualistic, and they were willing to allow marriage into their social vision as long as it didn't cramp their style, as long as it didn't put too many restrictions on them. That kind of thinking would corrode the very nature of the institution and make it attractive to people who are not even attracted to the opposite sex is, I think, predictable.
Let's talk about the dinks. You mentioned them before: double income, no kids. This is, as you say, measured in the thousands of heterosexual couples who started buying basset hounds rather than bassinets. What was going on in the late 60s, early 70s with regard to our thinking about marriage that led to this phenomenon?
Well, a number of things were happening. First, I guess I should preface what I say by acknowledging that there are many, I think, very good couples, married couples, who would dearly love to have children but simply can't. And I think that their difficult and often painful circumstance needs to be acknowledged. But that isn't the thing that undermined wedlock. What you saw is it was a conscious repudiation of the parenthood, and that came from I think the strongest impulse was simply individualism, selfishness. Children get in the way. They impose burdens. They are burdens. I want to live my own life. I want to do my own thing. I don't want to be tied down, taking care of kids, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, that kind of talk is less censured now than it was, but a couple of ideologies emerged that allowed people whose impulses were simply selfish to represent what they were doing as altruistic and public-minded. I'm talking about the scare in the 60s and 70s over the population boom, the neo-Malthusian fear of that the Earth will be burdened beyond its carrying capacity, and that, of course, reinforced by environmentalism, the fact that we've been below replacement fertility since the early 1970s has received remarkably little attention, and the very depressed fertility of other industrialized countries is a reality that many Americans don't even know about because it doesn't receive much attention in the media.
It became something of social obligation, Bryce, to kind of keep the population low, keep the family small. In its worst-case form, it might be the often-made argument for abortion, that it wouldn't be right to bring a child into the world like this, something like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that... Well, you've actually added one thing to what I've said, but it deserves attention that why bring children into a world like this, that would be unfair to the child and so on, but also the population boom and environmental concerns, that the responsible person, the environmentally conscious person would be the person who chose not to have children. And the fact that underneath that might be some just plain old-fashioned selfishness didn't receive much scrutiny.
You've written this, and I'd like to go through these points one by one in the time left to us. You write, why should we scramble? This is actually the advocate for homosexual marriage. You wonder why people, homosexuals, would want to get on, quote-unquote, the sinking ship of marriage as it is, but you say, but most homosexual couples now seeking to be married are doing so precisely because much of the traditional freight of marriage, complementary sexual roles, a role in a real home economy, childbearing, sexual fidelity, permanence, have been thrown overboard as the marital ship has settled even lower in the water. Let's talk about those things one by one. Complementary sexual roles, what do you mean?
Well, there was a time when it was understood that the husband and the wife bring different things to the marital union, and that they're complementary. That, and I'm not just talking about the 50s husband provider, a wife homemaker. I'm talking about a more ancient and sense of the husband as the protector, the parent who makes possible the nurturing realm in which the mother provides the love and the care of particularly the young children. To some degree these complementary roles were most natural in an agrarian society. They became a little more problematic in a modern industrial economy, but even in modern industrial economy, you did have this sense of gender complementarity well into the 60s, that the sense that husbands and wives bring different things to the marriage, and then when they become father and mother, they bring different things to parenting, and that the family and the children need both.
What about work in a real home economy? I think you touched upon it just a moment ago. The agrarian economy was largely a home-based economy.
Yes, indeed it was. And even well into the 60s, you had a lot of things happening in the home. Women had sewing machines and they sewed, and there was a lot of home baking, and there were backyard home gardens. The home was not simply a place for consuming things made elsewhere. It was a place where things were made, and including the most priceless thing made. That maybe that word isn't what I want, but fostered, created, were children. And even that now has moved off to, in many instances, to a daycare center where a paid parental surrogate does the child care, and so the child is the home has become what the Harvard sociologist Peterim Sorokin feared it would become, an incidental parking lot where things are not made, things are not produced, where we consume things. We consume things made elsewhere. We consume entertainment made elsewhere. Marriages were strengthened by the vitality of a real home economy. When the home simply became this incidental parking lot that Sorokin spoke of and warned of, then marriage was certainly jeopardized.
So I'm getting a picture here of kind of how far we have fallen, that when man and woman came together in previous generations, not too far back, and said, I do, there was in view for them and the community and the family an entire complex of home life, family, childbearing, everything that nowadays, when two people come together to say, I do, is simply no longer part of the formula.
I fear you're right. It's a personal accommodation. The marriage has been reduced in the eyes of many, and I'm talking about heterosexuals as well as homosexuals. It's simply a personal accommodation, not a moral challenge, a moral responsibility, a community responsibility for making a productive home, for rearing responsible, moral children. And those things simply have disappeared from view for many heterosexuals.
Bryce Christensen is our guest. He teaches English at Southern Utah University. He's authored the book Utopia Against the Family, and he's written an excellent article in Touchstone Magazine, the latest, titled Rush to the Altar, ALTER. We're talking about the de-evolution of marriage and homosexuality. In about 15 minutes, we'll open up the phone lines for your opinions on the president's faith-based initiatives, which figure as a major increase in his $2 billion budget submitted to Congress. We'll hear from Jim Toohey, director of White House Office for the Faith-Based Community Initiatives. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. What about sexual fidelity? You touched upon this earlier. When the sexual revolution began, was this a conscious target for the assault on marriage?
Well, Hugh Hefner said that in boasting of what he and his allies had accomplished, he said nothing had been reduced to less recognizable rubble than the institution of marriage. For sexual libertarians, wedlock was an impediment to free expression of sexual desire. Now, it became much less of an impediment as it became more of a revolving door, as divorce became much easier, as the expectation that couples would wait until they were married to have sexual relations. I mean, the white wedding dress was traditionally a symbol of sexual purity, and it wasn't homosexuals that attacked that symbolism, that hollowed out that symbolism. The whole, and even after, there still is in America, I think, a fairly strong presumption that a husband and wife will be sexually faithful to one another while they're married. But even that presumption has weakened, and it would have to weaken in an environment in which there is so much premarital sexual activity, and in which marriages can be terminated on a whim, and so the number of extramarital affairs has gone. I'm talking about heterosexuals. That has certainly gone up. In fact, that is one of the primary reasons for the sharp rise in divorce rates in the late 60s to 70s, and even though divorce rates have not continued to climb, they remain very high by historical standards, and that reflects the, among other things, reflects the erosion of the standard of sexual fidelity.
You know, nowadays we have the celebrity phenomenon, Bryce, of two bright young glitterati find each other, get married, and buy a house in Beverly Hills and another one in Palm Beach. And the question at the initial marriage is, will it last? Actually, it's even gone beyond that, Bryce. It's now people start taking bets when they say I do about how long it's going to last. They assume that the marriage will dissolve between these two people. Is this why when social conservatives talk about restoring marriage or protecting marriage, we sometimes get blank stares because the culture at large is saying, what are you talking about? What you talk about doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I fear you're right. Of course, it does exist, but it's less common. It's less common, and the spotlight is often on the very kinds of pseudo-marriages that you spoke of. These are, to call them even marriages, is to dishonor the word. I mean, the word marriage means commitment, and it means real commitment, and it means that you cleave unto none else, and that's what it has meant. That's what it still means for those who take the word in their lips with a sense of reverence and care.
So let's talk about a solution. This has obviously got to be pretty broad in the way this is dealt with, because these are big problems. What needs to happen in order for the substance of marriage to be restored?
Well, it needs to... I don't think that there's any one silver bullet, one magic solution. I think it requires individual couples. It requires individual souls to say, I'm not going that way. I'm going the way, the way Scripture teaches. I'm going the way my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents went. I'm going to make my union a forever union, a lifetime union. I'm not going to, it's in sickness and in health, it's the good, and that requires individual resolve. It also requires teaching children and raising the next generation with a sense of what marriage can and should be, and a real resistance to what some would make it, and some indeed have made it. I think that it requires religious leaders to affirm what Scripture teaches and not be bashful, not quietly walk away from what the Apostle Paul teaches about fleeing fornication, what the Lord Himself said about what God hath joined, let not man put asunder. I mean, I think it requires a recovery of what we as Americans had not so very long ago.
And to the person who says, well, I'm sorry to tell you this, Bryce, but the ship has sailed. As much as that would be nice to restore, it is not going to happen. It is simply unrealistic. In this day and age, marriage has devolved too far to return. How would you respond?
Well, I think that's the counsel of despair. And I think that it is possible. First of all, no one lives statistically, and I think that needs to be recognized. Even if 40% of new marriages end in divorce, yours doesn't have to be. Your marriage can be 100% intact. And as I said, no one lives statistically. The fact that 40% of the aggregate see their marriages fail doesn't mean that your marriage fails by 40%. Your marriage can be 100% successful. And I think that is true not only of individuals, I think it can be true of communities of virtue, if you will. You can create your own, if we're headed into a new dark age, create your own community of light, in which the kind of luminous presence that a successful marriage can create is strong, and such marriages are numerous.
Bryce Christensen is a teacher of English at Southern Utah University, author of the book Utopia Against the Family, and he's written this article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Rush to Altar. Bryce, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for the opportunity to be with you, Todd.
I like that phrase he used there a moment ago, community of virtue. That's really what marriage in the best sense was designed by God to be. For believer and unbeliever, a community of virtue, wherein the basic virtues of civil righteousness were fostered, were put into place with our children, and were continued to the next generation. Now, a lot of forces have conspired against that community of virtue. It's harder to think of marriage even in the terms that our grandparents or our great-grandparents thought about it, because we live in a very different world. But marriage has not changed. The essence of the thing has not changed. Man and woman have not changed. Children have not changed. It will mean, I think, at the very least this, living almost completely out of step with the rest of the world. Thinking in a way about your marriage that will not resonate in the culture and you won't find on primetime television. And being willing to, in your home, with your family, with your kids and your spouse, live counterculturally. I think that's what's required of everyone, believer and unbeliever, who are interested in restoring marriage as a community of virtue. Now, when we come back, open lines, I want to hear from you on faith-based initiatives, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
How is the Old Testament prophet Joshua a type of Christ? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. This commentary focuses on the faithfulness of God, how He kept His covenant promises, and how these promises are fulfilled in Christ. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse on our website at issuesetc.org. Read about the history, culture, and archaeology surrounding the Promised Land in this Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The cost is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Creationism. Now, what's it all about? Answers with Ken Ham, a popular speaker on the creation-evolution controversy. Now, Ken, have you ever had people ask you, what's the big deal? Why don't you spend more time arguing about more important biblical issues?
Well, yes, I have had people say that. People often wonder why we don't spend more time on issues such as baptism, the Sabbath, predestination versus free will, last days, and so on. But here's the difference. All these debates already start with the belief that the Bible is the authority. Then they argue over what that means. The creation issue is about whether the Bible or modern secular science is the authority on what happened in Earth's past. But the Bible is the eyewitness account of the Maker who was there, knows everything, and always tells the truth. But scientists weren't always there, don't know everything, and make mistakes. Now, when I talk about Genesis, people think I'm just dealing with such things as the 6 days of creation, Noah's flood, and so on. But the real issue is whether we can trust God's word from the very first verse. The creation evolution issue is one concerning authority. Do we accept that God is the absolute authority or fallen man?
Well, what does God's word say about why there's so much death and suffering in this world? For the answer, you can read Ken Ham's free booklet on our popular website, AnswersRadio.com. It's also a great witnessing tool. Read Ken Ham's free booklet on death and suffering when you go to AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. How would you define the word family? According to the Bible, your family consists of those to whom you are related by blood, marriage, or adoption. Part of the breakdown of the American family today consists in redefining the term. In sitcoms, popular songs, and movies, the word family is often used to refer to any group of people living together. Don't let your children be misled by this. As Christian parents, remind your children that Jesus loved them enough to die on the cross for them, and He has also given them a real family who loves and nurtures them. Your family is a blessing to be appreciated and treasured. It is not a theoretical term to be redefined by the media. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Well, we have concluded our study of the book of Acts on our Bible study program, and we now turn our attention back to the Old Testament. We'll study the book of Joshua, and next time we'll do an introductory program to that Old Testament book. Our guest will be Pastor John Schmidtke of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in St. Louis. Listen to the Bible study weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to the last 25 minutes. It's open lines. During this half hour, I'm forcing myself to deal with a subject that mystifies me and has mystified me for 4 years. Faith-based initiatives. Now, why does it mystify me? It keeps coming up. I keep reading headlines about it. And yet I sense absolutely no enthusiasm. Now, maybe I'm just don't have my antenna out. I sense absolutely no enthusiasm for this particular issue. The president's budget was submitted to Congress on Monday. $2 trillion all said, and some of that increases in federal funding for faith-based initiatives. We're going to be hearing from Jim Toohey here, director of the White House Office for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, in just a moment. I want to hear from you. I want to hear from anybody on this. What do you think about faith-based initiatives? Do they spark anything with you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Little story before we get started here. I distinctly remember the moment. It's one of those times where you remember where you were and what you were doing. And you say, what, when Kennedy was shot? No, I wasn't born yet. What, when we landed on the moon? Yeah, I remember that. But here is the political moment that turned for me. 1989, might have been late 88. I'm in Bay City, Michigan, doing my vicarage, a year of internship there, sitting in this old house we lived in next door to the church, watching my little black and white television, and I'm watching George W. Bush, not George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, his dad, deliver a speech. It was the Thousand Points of Light speech. Now, you're going to think I'm the biggest geek and the biggest wonk in the world, and maybe I am, but I'm watching this, and you thought you got excited about George Bush and his 1,000 points of light speech? I did. I thought, finally, here is a president, and this was after, they're all doing the loser sign to me. Finally, this is a president and a speechwriter that after 8 years of Ronald Reagan that I was very enthusiastic about. I mean, I was a big Reaganite, a disciple. But I thought, this is something I've never heard in U.S. politics yet. And here I am, rock-ribbed conservative, listening to George Bush talk about 1,000 points of light, that he looks out at America and he sees a dark night sky, but in that velvety dark sky there is 1,000 points of light. And he's talking about churches and homes and community-based things. And I'm thinking to myself, finally, I'm hearing something from a politician that isn't the standard boilerplate. Yes, I thought I was one of those 1,000 points of light. I think that was the whole point. They're laughing at me here. I was inspired. Now, by the way, I have been vindicated in my inspiration because the 1,000 points of light speech has gone down as one of the greater speeches that George Bush the First made. But I'll be honest with you, as inspired as I was by 1,000 points of light, the version that has been brought back again, the whole faith-based initiatives, which sounds very bureaucratic to me. At least 1,000 points of light has some poetry to it. Faith-based initiatives sounds like a name that only a bureaucrat could love. Well, in any event, here it comes, and I'll be honest with you folks, I'm mystified at how it continues to make headlines. Does anyone care about faith-based initiatives? It's a priority in the president's budget. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Give me a call now. Let's talk with Steve, who's calling from his car. Steve, welcome.
How you doing?
Very well.
Here's my problem with faith-based initiatives. It puts the church in bed with the government. And as long as you're happy with whoever's in the office, be it Republican or Democrat, life's good. But, you know, elections come, we change parties, and suddenly you're now taking some money from someone you may not care for. And what happens when they start putting on requirements? When they start saying, oh, you have to have certain hiring policies about who you hire. There's certain things you can and cannot say. Suddenly what happens is you're more concerned about following the rules than you are doing the mission.
Well, those are great points, Steve. In fact, you reflect almost word for word my initial reaction to faith-based initiatives. It didn't excite me, the thing itself. I was just seeing warning signs, and that is, this is going to be strings attached. There are always strings attached. And, yeah, you're right, Steve. When the people you trust are in power and handing out the money to you, then faith-based initiatives seem like a great idea. But when someone else is in power and they're handing out money to somebody else, and maybe not you, then maybe it's not such a great idea, or even if they are giving you money. All right, now that was an objection to faith-based initiatives. Steve at least had enough interest in it by way of objection to pick up the phone and dial the phone and register an opinion. What about the rest of you? Do you even care? It must be something, because the White House has been pushing this as hard as almost anything else. Certainly harder than, say, efforts in the Middle East. Certainly harder than, say, I would say even harder than tax reform on a more regular basis. The only thing that outdoes it that I can think of right off the top of my head is the war in Iraq. That this administration has pushed harder than faith-based initiatives. As often as it's in the press, and we're talking on a weekly basis, there's an article, and I'm wondering why. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jim Toohey is director of the White House Office for Faith-Based Initiatives. You might not have even known that. Why? Because maybe you don't even care. Maybe you do. Well, he says that President Bush's budget boosts funding for drug treatment, maternal group homes, reentry of prisoners into society, mentoring children of prisoners, and the Compassion Capital Fund.
The request is for $385 million. This represents a $150 million increase over 2005 appropriated amounts for those programs.
Over one-third of $1 billion. goes to those programs, and that's not the entire list of faith-based initiatives. Tui also says that Bush's budget calls for a $150 million increase in funding for five key programs.
That continues to support partnerships between faith-based and community groups and government so that they can work together to address pressing social problems. In addition, I think not only is President Bush's budget compassionate, it gives greater choices to the poor and disadvantaged in terms of social service providers and access to programs.
Now, that term compassionate does play in pretty strongly here. Could it be this? That this is the way that the Bush administration has decided to pursue the compassionate part of compassionate conservative? That is, we will have this going over here, faith-based initiatives, and so we will be compassionate, and we will also have all the other traditional concerns of conservative Republicans. We will be conservative. And is this why it seems to matter more to the White House than to anybody else? If you voted for President Bush last fall, what role, if any, did his stance on faith-based initiatives play in your decision to vote? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You don't plunk. Now, I know the government throws money around like it's going out of style. And I know that government money is not measured in the thousands or the ten or the hundreds of thousands or even in the millions anymore. It's always in the billions and hundreds of billions. But here we are talking about one-third of $1 billion, more than that, for a few faith-based initiatives. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Finally, Jim Tui, director of the White House Office for Faith-Based Initiatives, says that President Bush wants to increase funding for faith-based programs. Why? Because they work.
He has continued to maintain a strong belief that partnerships between government and America's armies of compassion mean a lot in the lives of our poor.
All right, we've talked a lot about this on the program, especially when it first started out. And if you listen to many of the conversations we have that aren't specifically about faith-based initiatives, that partnership between government and communities of compassion, that's what first got my attention when I heard the first President Bush talking about 1,000 points of light. Yeah, bringing churches, communities of faith, faith-based groups to the table to help solve America's problems. So why is it that, I mean, to be quite honest with you, that when I see a headline about faith-based initiatives, I'd rather read the back of the shampoo bottle than read that article. And it's not because I have anything against it. I don't have anything against it. I have concerns like Steve had. It's that, to be quite honest, and call me non-compassionate, if you will, it sparks no interest in me whatsoever. Open lines, issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Derek is up next, calling from his car. Derek, welcome.
Hi, Pastor Todd.
Hi.
Actually, when I hear about faith-based initiatives, I get disturbed. And I think that my concerns are the same that you have and that the previous caller, Steve. It bothers me, and I would count myself as an evangelical, but it bothers me to hear evangelicals getting excited about it for two reasons. First of all, government can never do anything as efficiently or as cheaply as the private sector. And secondly, not only do you have the government getting its fingers into the inner workings of our churches, but you've got the government defining what is and what is not a legitimate religion. And that really, really is bothersome. And it bothers me that more evangelicals, more Christians don't see that and really, really back away.
Derek, thank you. Does anyone listening support the president's faith-based initiatives push? I want to hear from you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Well, Derek has the same objections, plus a few. And actually, if I think about it, is it the government's business? Is it within the purview of government to define what a legitimate religion is? I'm not talking about churches. I'm talking about a legitimate religion. And, you know, there are religions that can be rather distasteful in some respects, but can be altruistic. They can do good in the public square. We had a call earlier in the previous open lines about Scientologists. What if the Scientologists wanted government money to run a, what do? They do rehab. In fact, they have a very successful rehab program. Some of the most famous people you'll ever hear of have been through the Scientologists' rehab program. They run a couple places throughout the country where if you've got a serious cocaine problem, drug problem, prescription drug problem, you name it, you can go to these rehab centers that are run by the Church of Scientology. Now, you might come out clean and sober. You might also come out clean, sober, and a Scientologist. Now, if I'm Mr. Scientologist who's running my rehab program, I'm saying this fits beautifully within the president's faith-based initiatives. I want me some of that government money, and I probably would get some. While Scientology remains all the while a cult. Still nothing. Is this the kind of stuff that puts you to sleep at night? Instead of taking a sleeping pill, do you pick up in the paper and read about the faith-based initiatives? What do you think about the objections so far? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When it's shown on the ground, it usually has to do with working in the inner city, working with people who are on the fringes of society, that is, prisoners who are re-entering society, people who have been disenfranchised by means of economy or circumstances of life or marriage. Okay, let's put it this way. Orphans. Orphans, by virtue of their place without parents, become in one sense or another the responsibility of the greater community. Now, the government says most orphanages and most adoption agencies, we don't even use the word orphanage anymore, do we? Most adoption agencies are privately run. Some are run by the state, but most of them are privately run. So this is doing something good. This is getting kids put back into families and back into society in a healthful way. And we want to encourage that because that fills in the gaps where government can't work. You know, Derek had an objection, but I can think of a response to his objection that government cannot do anything as efficiently or as cheaply or as well as the private sector. And by and large, I agree. But the person who's in favor of faith-based initiatives, whom I have yet to meet, someone who's gung-ho for it, I have yet to meet, might respond, that's exactly why we're doing faith-based initiatives, because the government can supply the money very efficiently. We'll let you guys spend it with the efficiency of the private sector in ways that will relieve the burden in the long run because it's being done more efficiently on the taxpayer. So as a taxpayer, do you have any interest in this? If this means that money that the government would otherwise be spending itself through its own means to take care of society's problems and doing that at an alarmingly inefficient rate is now being done, government money, now being done through private agencies, faith-based communities, at a much more efficient rate, ergo saving you money. Does it even appeal to you in terms of your pocketbook? Craig is calling from Pasadena, California. He listens on the internet. Craig, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Todd.
Hey, Craig.
You know, I've had go-rounds with congressmen and that sort of thing on this whole issue, people out dumping for Bush's faith-based initiative, and they made it clear that you're not allowed to proselytize if you're taking their money and using it for a certain function. Like, say you're feeding the poor or something like that, you can take the money, but you're not allowed to tell them about Jesus. And I had Congressman Watts, when he was thumping on this, he told me that, you know, the function of the church is to take care of the poor. And I said, no, the function of the church is to preach the gospel. We take care of the poor so that we might preach the gospel to them. And that is not what the church is here for. It isn't just to take care of the poor. It's to get the crucified Savior out to the people that need it. And he said, well, if you're going to have that kind of attitude, you better not apply for any money.
Okay.
I've got problems with this because when the government's involved with the church, the government's involved in the church. And I don't want the government in my church.
I can understand the concern there. Can you see any way, Craig, of a clear of, say, taking funding from the government in order to help feed the poor or build affordable and decent housing, something along those lines?
Not as the church, because here's the problem, Todd. with someone like George Bush in there who's a Christian and has respect for the church, it's all fine and dandy. But then the church becomes dependent on the government money in order to continue to do these good works. And then you get someone in there who's evil like Hillary or something. You get her elected. And, of course, she has no patience for Christians. And so what's going to happen? All the stipulations are going to start coming out. You can have this money if you do this, if you do that. And the church is going to lose its fangs. And once you become dependent on that money, it's going to be real hard to become undependent because you have all your programs dependent on it.
Okay, one more question before I let you go, Craig. According to this scenario, and I got to admit, I mean, you quote J.C. Watts there, you better not apply for the money. It strikes me then that the liberal so-called Christian organizations will be the ones benefiting from Bush's faith-based initiatives and the money that comes therefrom. Why? Because although they say they want to proselytize, they're not ashamed of not proselytizing. They'll feed the poor and they'll call that evangelism. And they'll say, hey, we were proselytizing. We were putting food into people's stomachs. And they don't care whether they proclaim Jesus or not.
Sure.
So all the money ends up with them.
Yeah, you want to go that route, go ahead and become ELCA or Episcopalian. That's fine. But for the churches that are willing to stand tall for the truth of the gospel, they're the ones that are going to end up facing some sort of compromise, either financially or in their message that they're getting out. So the question becomes, what's more important, the program that we're putting on or the message that we're trying to push as a church?
Thank you, Craig. Thanks for listening on the Internet as well. So we've got Steve, Derek, Craig. I'm not hearing a lot of love for faith-based initiatives, not a lot of enthusiasm. In fact, so far, only concern, only caveats. What about the rest of you? Call now, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. A few more minutes left in open lines. I kind of had to force myself to do this because I'll be honest with you, this does not pique my interest. But I wonder why I keep on hearing about it and why it is a priority with President George W. Bush. I have my concerns. I don't know if my concerns go as deep as all the callers, but at this point I'm not hearing a lot of support or enthusiasm for faith-based initiatives. You know, we talk with Pastor Matt Harrison, who is executive director of LCMS World Relief. And when there's a tsunami in the Far East, they're there. But also when there's a hurricane in Florida, they're there. And there is a very, I don't know where the money flows. I won't speak for Pastor Harrison, but we've talked about helping, reaching out, cooperating as communities of faith in externals and feeding the poor and taking care of people whose houses have been washed away and all that kind of stuff. I don't know that we've ever talked about faith-based initiatives. Now, you can do it without government money. It can be done, you know. And Craig does raise a very real concern about dependency on that money. Alan is calling from his car. Alan, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor.
Hi.
I'm kind of bitter about this whole business. The faith-based initiative sounds real good, but doesn't actually play out, and it actually winds up burdening a lot of fledgling charitable effort.
How is that?
I think that it winds up dumping a bunch of stuff that was originally better actually managed through federal and state grant programs. Go ahead.
Alan, so what you're saying here is that this may be a backdoor way of the government saying, look, we're not interested in funding at the same level all our bureaucracy to get these things done. A cheaper way to do it is to employ these outside faith-based, outside government faith-based organizations. We can do it much cheaper, and they really get the responsibility and the burden for this.
And the liability.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. Alan, thank you very much. Okay, that's four. Apparently women really don't care about this, but four, nothing but concerns so far. Not a lot of support. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. There must be something to it. Really, there must be something to it. This is maybe what I should do, and I might be surprised, and maybe our callers are not indicative of the national mood on faith-based initiatives. Look at some of the polling data, see how people vote. I don't think faith-based initiatives appeared in the exit polling in November as a significant factor in anyone's vote. I'm pretty sure of that answer. How does it come up? Why is it that this continues to be pushed as hard as anything save the war by the Bush administration? And try to come up with some answer, because for the life of me, nothing against George W. Bush, and God love him for trying to do something here that is not only outside the box for government, but also something that will help people at the grassroots, where money can actually make it to the grassroots without being siphoned off by 100 bureaucrats in 100 cubicles in 100 buildings. So good intentions, however, pave the highway to a lot of very nasty places. We've had callers raise those concerns. Craig raised the issue of dependency. That's the last thing that any church, I won't speak for parachurch organizations, but any church ought to find themselves doing. That is being dependent on the government for anything. Not because the government's necessarily bad. Good government is a blessing from God. That we need to affirm here at the end of this conversation. Good government is a blessing from God. But the church ought to be doing these things. Caring for the poor, those who are in need, reaching out to community, serving everyone, serving their neighbor, whoever they are and wherever they find them in their vocation, without any money from anyone. This is part of what it means to be the church in the world. That dependency that Craig warns about is a legitimate concern, but the church, if it has its head on straight about what it ought to be doing, proclaiming Christ, and how do we speak about this? Living before God by faith and our neighbor in love. What does that love do? When we are freed of the burden of pleasing God ourselves, and all of our works that the Holy Spirit works in us can now be given freely away to our neighbor. We don't need to keep them or storehouse them. What does this mean? What does this love mean? It means that we will first and foremost be concerned about our neighbor as a sinner. That is, the biggest problem they have is their sin, and the only solution to that is not in a full belly, but in the cross of Jesus Christ. That's the first thing on our lips, but also along with that, helping them in every way we can. And we don't need the government's money to do that. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.